Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Temple Hayes, who is the author of When Did You Die? 8 Steps to Stop Dying Every Day and Start Waking Up. Temple is a prophet and a mystic, and she is a spiritual leader at the Unity Campus in St. Petersburg, Florida. And she's written a book on how we can stop dying every day and wake up. Thanks for joining us, Temple.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. And, you know, when I was asked to be on your show and looking your show up and all the work that you're doing, I had a little laugh that it was called Temple of Health.
Right.
Because I feel like, you know, if we do choose our names for this lifetime, I definitely choose one that keeps me in check with myself at any given moment, you know. So thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Temple, did you ever read about the Temple Beautiful in Atlantis?
No, I did not. That sounds like something I need to do.
You do. It's Edgar Cayce first brought in the information about the Temple Beautiful. There were a lot of genetic mutations back then because there was genetic stuff, experimentation going on. Of course, this is before recorded history, although there are some... There's information that's channeled about it. Mm-hmm. And I was actually in charge of the Temple Beautiful. I was a surgeon then, and I'm a surgeon now. How's that?
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Wow, that's awesome. And I love the work of Edgar Cayce. Talk about a mystic and a prophet. There you
right.
go.
Yeah. Mm. Well, you know, it's like the descriptions of the Temple Beautiful. When life gives us things that aren't right, you know, extra digits, you know, extra things that are not working for us, we do need to seek out how to fix that. And your book kind of describes that for when you're given things that aren't quite right, you know, dysfunctional families, dysfunctional relationships, that you just don't have to put up with it and be unhappy. You can actually ask for help, ask for guidance, and have these things fixed, learn the lessons, and then go on.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and for me, it's like at any given time in my life when there's been immense challenges, whether as an individual, in community, or as a nation or world, to me, we want to make these unexpected, tragic moments, dysfunctions, whatever we may call them, we want to make them matter. And my crawling in a hole or becoming a drug addict or someone that doesn't want to show up for life anymore is not making it matter. So for
right.
me, you know, collectively, and, you know, when I look at people, I mean, first of all, you know, I've been saying as a speaker for years, who doesn't perceive that they came from some kind of dysfunctional family? Even people that had the golden spoon in their mouth feel like, well, you know, I didn't have to work at what I have. I mean, it's all relative to our perspective, right? But deepening mm-hmm. all of that, I had to, for my own sanity and awareness and healthier well-being, realize that I had been shaped for something greater than just a chain of events that I would have preferred not to happen.
Right. You talk about addiction, and I think that a lot of people choose what you chose as a teenager, which is to numb themselves. But I think it's important to understand what Discalus talked about. Discalus is one of the modern-day masters. He lived in Cyprus. And he described addictions better than anything I've ever seen. And one of my friends, who's a psychiatrist here in town in Atlanta, actually studied with him. So I got to understand his teachings at a, you know, at another level than just his writings. But Discalus talked that whenever we have an addiction or a desire thought, it takes a little bit of our life force energy from us out of the etheric field. So if you're craving whatever it is, you know, alcohol, drugs, sex, any addiction that there is, gambling, it actually will zap your life force energy. And there's a mechanism by which that occurs that Discalus describes. You may want to look that up.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm so in and totally believe that. And as a shaman doing soul retrieval on people through the years, I always see those images in their soul path where there's been some form of addiction, even though at that particular moment they may not be, you know, still participating or practicing. For me as a child, in one level, I feel like I was almost trained to be addictive. In other words, was given sugar in just about every meal. You know, mm-hmm. back then in the 60s, we didn't know better. Even now, in 2015, we know better, but people still choose to do it. But I just had so much sugar in my diet that the next level of it being wine would be the next evolution, in addition to all the soda, you know, that I had growing mm-hmm. up. But the other element of that is that I think by the time I was a teenager, I longed so deeply to fit in somewhere, just mm-hmm. somewhere, that was the up-and-coming, you know, what kids around me were doing. And I definitely got a strong message from the universe, this is not yours to do. And I think everybody does, but it's just a question of what do we listen to. The first time I smoked a cigarette, I went into almost full-blown tonsillitis. Mm-hmm, and the right. first time I drank beer, I had like flu-like symptoms for several days. So my body had no interest in that, you know, whatsoever. And I will say the trip didn't get much better. It didn't improve that much. The best I ever had of fun would not be anything that was memorable. And most of the times I had under the influence of alcohol, I had to ask somebody else how it went anyway. So, but it was very primary to me, and that how I had felt I had always been rejected. So by that time, I started rejecting myself. And that's right. where that other level of not being in alignment with who I am came into manifestation, if you will.
So what is your advice for people who find themselves at that stage of life?
Currently, people that are currently using right now,
or
do you mean
not,
people
not
that are
using,
are getting the insight not to do it and keep doing it, or
people who are not fitting in and are, I mean, I'm not so much the addiction part. That's a path you went down because of this other cause, though, or this other problem. The problem being that you didn't really love yourself. You didn't really have the things within you to determine your own destiny at that point.
Right. Right. Well, now I consider not fitting in an immense compliment. You know, the me that I am today, when I don't fit in, I go, thank you. You know, being different is like one of the greatest compliments. Being unique is one of the greatest compliments. But we, for the people that are not at that vibratory level, that feels right or it sounds too woo-woo for them, because for me it's immensely real. I wouldn't trade being different for anything, but back in the time and in its day of standing out in spirituality and sexuality in just about every way proven true, I stood out as different. And what I would say is that to try to go with the masses, to have a fake experience, a non-authentic reality of I'm fitting in, it just eventually causes long-term pain and more trauma and drama to one's being. So to sit in a place now of the knowing that you don't feel like you belong and you don't fit in, the first step to that is to own that, not in a way that you are a mistake, but to own it, that there is some wisdom behind the reason that you are created in that way.
And I think that people need to realize that there are other people out there, maybe not in your city or town, especially if you live in a small town, but there are other people out there that are at your vibratory level that you can connect with. And that has great healing power. So, you know, in the days of internet and different interest groups, and I think that in different, especially if you're into spirituality, networking with other people, even through the Unity Church. I mean, I met a lot of people at Unity that were similar to me vibrationally, whereas, you know, at other churches they wouldn't be. So
why?
I think networking with other people similar to you, even if you're all different than the norm, gives you a sense of community, which is important. I think, you know, just being a loner to an extreme is not as valuable as finding people who are similar to you.
Absolutely. That's very well put. And it wasn't that way in the 60s. You know, you couldn't go to meetup.com and say, I feel adopted. What about you?
So yeah, that's right.
Definitely, if you were going to be into your uniqueness and you're feeling odd and unique or gifted, or you have psychic abilities, or you have the ability to intuitively be able to support somebody with their health or well-being, well, you're born at the right time.
Right.
Or a really good time, you know, for that. Because like you said, you can look for meetup groups. I tend to, no matter about the relationships on the internet, and I think they're wonderful and valuable, just as this show, and we're able to reach people that normally we wouldn't be able to reach. But when it comes to people I choose in my personal life, in my tribe, if you will, I'm like you. I want to start out first and foremost at an open-ended spiritual kind of community that gives me more of an essence of who somebody is. And we also have the Centers for Spiritual Living that are a whole other, you know, New Thought organization that are very supportive, and they're all over the world as well. So for me, when I started looking at, you know, the difference between, and this is what I started exploring, you know, if on some level we choose where we're born and all the elements around that, and a lot of people could debate that, but whether we do or not, more than likely we didn't do it consciously, you know. I don't think consciously people say, oh, I'd love to have cancer. That'd probably help me change my life. I don't feel that consciously we do a lot of things. Our soul on this other level, obviously, we're put in circumstances, places to have a broadening of who we are. But for me, what made my life make the most sense, because why would a mystic be born to just a little small town with small-minded people, many of them, if not the majority of them, still living there, and what would make that make sense? Why within me was I given messages at 5 years old that you're here to bring a message to the world? Well, what does that mean? You know, when at the time I couldn't even get my grandmother to feel comfortable talking in the conversations I was talking in, you know, and when you're 5 or 6 years old, that's like, what? You know, and people will say to me, they'll say, you know, God, you were so lucky. And I go, well, yeah, if I had been, you know, in the type of community that would have said, well, let's send you to a mystery school and explore what this is. But it didn't feel that way, you know, for a long time. But I've learned now the distinction between my birth story of I'm born into a family, into a system, into an environment, into a community, what have you, and my sacred story. And my sacred story are the experiences that I have walked through, kind and unkind, the teachers, kind and unkind, the light, the shadow, the darkness, that have played a part in my development so I could prepare myself for that message that I heard as a child. Because now I can sit in it comfortably, where for many years that would have not been the case.
Well, I think sometimes, too, that the early training for this kind of work is to have you isolated at the point where you then strengthen that message from within.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that I had a similar experience. I didn't have a really troubled childhood, but I had full spiritual sight and hearing as a child that fortunately my family did support rather than, you know, ridicule. They weren't super religious, which I think helps. I think when you have like a Southern Baptist family and you then start telling people who's going to die and, you know, other things that you can't possibly know other than from the devil, you know, in their minds, you're going to have trouble.
Yeah.
But you know, I still think that there is a strengthening of that connection with that sort of isolation. Whereas if you had been in a fully supportive environment, you wouldn't have had to rely on that connection as much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very well said. Very well said.
So, I mean, and adversity, like you say, adversity makes you stronger in that you learn to really learn to love yourself if nobody else around you is doing that for you. Do you see? It's like if you have to come out of really a lot of environment of conditional love, and your lesson you're trying to learn is unconditional love, then sometimes that's the environment you're put in, so that you can really come out strongly with unconditional love. Because you love the people, you're able to learn to love the people that didn't love you. And that's like the worst scenario of unconditional love, is loving those who, you know, who are only give you conditional love.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've been saying for many years, it's so easy to welcome and embrace those people that think you're wonderful and give you nice pats on the back. That's the more simplicity relationship with life. It's an entirely different thing to embrace the people that don't get you, don't see you, mm-hmm. don't believe you really are who you say you are, and, you know, all those kind of things. And for me, the wisdom and the huge takeaway was, over the years, learning how to say, well, is there any nugget of truth in what they're saying? And mm-hmm. what would that nugget be if I was willing to sit in that space and see what that adversarial presence was? More often mm-hmm. than not, a couple of things could happen. One would be that I would see, oh, they are reminding me of somebody else from long ago, mm-hmm. and they are bringing now currently an opportunity for me to heal and reveal that within myself. And
right.
I found that, you know, time and time and time again. And I think that there's just so many people, even though we have the secret and we talk about the law of attraction, I think often, and I'm sure you, you know, see this all the time with the emotional part. You know, they always say it's good to know what we're eating. That's one dynamic as far as a vibrant life, but we also need to know what's eating us. And when it comes to the emotional body, which would be my understanding of like a devil, of something that's working against mm-hmm. us, unless we've made peace with it, because the word devil is the word lived, spelled backwards. So it's usually that we keep projecting our past over and over and over again into our current circumstances. And I think for me, you know, often when I would encounter this adversity or people that would talk about me, and I get talked about a lot because I'm in public life, and that just goes with the territory, you know, doctors and spiritual leaders, people talk about us. Kind and unkind, it just is what is with it, you know. But one day I just, for some reason, had this huge aha of, I no longer need this experience because I no longer need to get into the depth of what it feels like to be rejected. and keep right. projecting onto whatever, whoever that person mm-hmm. is, that they are absolutely rejecting me. I have no energy about this whatsoever anymore. I feel complete mm-hmm. with this particular task as a soul. And it's very interesting. I've never faced that since.
Yeah, my mother once told me that she had never met anybody that had so little concern about what other people thought about them as I had. You know, I came into this life not, and you know, it's almost like in your next life temple, you're going to just come into it not caring, you know, like it,
right,
it will make no
exactly.
difference to you know, people can come say anything they want about you, and you'll just sit there and shrug it off, you know, because of this lifetime.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it actually is very freeing. I used to tell people in high school, don't worry about what other people are saying about you or even doing towards you. They're really only concerned about themselves. And then people would go, oh, my God, you're right. You know, people are, especially in high school, they're thinking about themselves. They're not thinking about you. They're really not. They may make some offhanded comment that hurts you, but that's not where their thoughts are. Their thoughts really are about themselves. Do they fit
absolutely.
In? You know?
Absolutely.
So,
and I think
so why should
described...
you concern yourself with someone who's essentially narcissistic? Now, hopefully later on we grow out of that. But as a teenager, you know, most teenagers are only really concerned about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not true of everybody. I mean, there are some... you know, very advanced teenagers out there that I've met. But in general, at least in the 60s, when I was in high school and junior high, I think that it was very, very true. And so I just was stating the obvious. And if that is true, then you really shouldn't worry about these small little things. You can't blow them up and make them into great, you know, crises in your life, because in 15 minutes, they're going to be off doing something else. That was my observation of the whole thing. So I wouldn't let a comment that somebody made hurt me, because they weren't even that conscious that they made it.
Right. Or, you know, the other profound thing is you go back and you could talk to that same person, you know, years and years and years later, and they would tell you, oh, that wasn't even what I meant, you know.
Exactly.
And I think that even though you're describing a particular era or time in our lives, I think that we still have a lot of teenager adults running around in adult bodies, and that still just is true of wisdom now as any time. Someone once said to me, it will only mean as much as you make it mean. And I love that. I love that.
Yeah. And the thing I really liked in your book, I think you said you were in your 30s when you had that conversation with your mother, when you asked her, you know, do you love me and will you always love me? And then you had the conversation about your sexuality.
I was in my 40s.
40s? Wouldn't it have been
just
lovely
the other day?
To have done that,
so I was in my 40s then, yeah.
Right. Wouldn't it have been lovely if you could have done that sooner?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. But see, for me,
it was a big difference.
It would have, but in talking about the emotional body, it wasn't about me as an adult, because I had left my family years ago and had lived my life and been in relationships with a man and a long-term relationship with a woman. And deep inside myself, I mean, you know, after so long, the things start adding up, you know, the questions that people ask you start adding up, and they go, oh, okay, yeah, uh-huh, and you love San Francisco, and you do this, and yeah, okay, yeah, you're in a same-sex relationship, check, you know. But it was more that I would be overwhelmed with the sensation of my childhood.
Right.
Of that memory of when they took my mom away from me and did shock treatments on her brain in a barbaric method because they thought that she had done something wrong. And so even though as an adult I'd be walking through life, more often than not kind of open about my life, that sensation of my childhood would totally stop me in my tracks until I became so aware of of how deep that that sensation was, and went, you know what, I'm going to face that worst, deepest fear. And
right.
That would be the relationship with the person that stretched enough so I could be born. Now it's my mm-hmm. time to stretch so I can really
right.
be born. And it changed my life forever. It absolutely did.
And I think that, you know, you being able to be true and honest with your mother, I mean, that's very, very important. You talk in your book about every time you tell a little white lie, it takes energy from you. You probably know about applied kinesiology or muscle testing. If people
oh, yeah.
don't believe that,
uh-huh.
you know, we always start out with, you know, my name is Susan and I'm very strong. And then I say my name is Charlie and I'm weak. So every time I say a lie, even if it's just to differentiate on muscle testing, you weaken your energy system. And what's interesting is I've been muscle testing for years now, and I've yet to find a patient who was strong on their on anything but their given name. You know how many people will not use their given name but use another name? They're
right.
always weak. Well, just think about that. Every time they say my name is, and then they say a name other than their given name, they're weakening their energy system. That must be incredibly interesting, you know, in terms of not being able to have as much energy as you should have going through life. So you can see what weakens you with muscle testing. If you don't believe, you know, what we're saying, what you're saying in the book, and what I'm saying on the show, you can test it for yourself.
There's no doubt about it, and that, you know, I was reading some statistics not long ago, and how we have shifted as a culture in lying, you know, and how now like 75% of people say that, you know, lying about your weight or, you know, and mm-hmm. and all those different kind of things, like they consider that to be like okay, versus any kind of repercussions or anything that would, you know, come from that. I know that I've had a friend along the way tell me that, you know, they went on Match.com, oh, but I didn't tell them the truth about my age. And I said, and that's how you really want to start out a relationship?
Start a relationship,
Seeking someone that's spiritual and truthful and mindful, that's how you're going to start out? Living a lie?
I don't think so.
Hello? Yeah. I don't think so. I'm going to just act like I didn't hear that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look mm-hmm. at our institutions. I mean, look at how many people believe that their congressmen are truthful. I mean, think about that. How many people believe that people in the government are telling us the truth? I mean, we don't live in a society where truth is valued.
No,
we don't. Not at our institutional level.
No, we don't. That's very well put.
So I think, and you know, when that changes, then you know there'll be templates that will be more solid. But when politicians are continually getting caught in lies, you know, writing bad checks, you know, on and on and on, and that's in the news, then people are, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, what I do isn't so bad. It's a bad example. But
it is. It's terrible modeling, and it. I get. Let's see, what would be the word? I don't want to say it's exciting, but it's good to see that more and more to the forefront, people that are pretentious and are not being authentic in where they are comes to light. I think we're going to see more of that over time, no doubt about it.
Well, we're already seeing a lot of things come to light. A lot of the conspiracy theories, a lot of the, you know, the activities that were covert are coming to light. There's an energy wave coming in that's exposing all sorts of stuff, and you know that's it's just basically a warning to people out there who have lived in secrecy and lived in lies and perpetuated great, atrocities. All of that's going to be uncovered in the next few years. And, I think we're all going to be a lot better off when those people are not in power anymore.
Yeah.
So,
we're on the same page.
I believe that's what's happening. I believe, if you follow the alternative media about how many arrests are being made and how many, there's just a whole movement out there to get corruption out of the hands of the powers that be. So, or get a government that's not based on that kind of corruption. Not just a government in the U.S. either. This is worldwide.
A new awakening. And
right.
And with people individually, you're just kidding yourself if you are, if your body's telling you this is not good for you and you deny it, it eventually, what I say in the book is, eventually all those white lies, our body will lie us down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about necessarily dying, a physical death, but we have to get into truth about that, because the body doesn't thrive when we put things in it that it really doesn't want.
What I recommend to my patients is that they muscle test. There's a lot of food allergies out there right now, mainly because the food sources are contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Corn, GMO corn, and the Roundup on the wheat. And, a lot of people are allergic to wheat, but they're not really allergic to the wheat part of it. They're allergic to the chemicals that are on it. So you can muscle test and determine what is the problem, and then you can even get something like NAIT or the allergy elimination techniques to undo that allergy. So there's things you can do other than just eliminate just about everything out there, because then it's very hard to eat, especially if you're eating in restaurants or in, at medical meetings like I do. You've got to be smart about it. You've got to figure out how to get around the allergies. And then if you
right.
do take toxins into your body, how to detox. You can take a certain level of toxins into your body if you know how to detox. It's better not to take them in, obviously. But if you can't avoid that, then become knowledgeable about detoxification so you can get them back out.
It's so wonderful that you're doing this work,
Well, thank you.
It just couldn't be needed at a greater time with so many sensitivities to allergies and things that are showing up because of processed food and, other things that we have.
Yeah.
So thank you.
It started with breast.
Thank you for doing what you're doing.
It started with the chemicals in breast implants, when the implants became defective and started leaching chemicals, and people develop Raynaud's disease from methylethylketone depleting arginine and platinum toxicity and all these other, problems. I had to learn detox for hydrophilic and hydrophobic chemicals, and I had to, figure out, and fortunately I have the radio show, so I could interview anybody, so I wasn't limited to what was in writing. I could actually pick their brains, and so that's how I learned a lot about detox. And then, there was a lot more to learn about GMO. I interviewed Jeffrey Smith on numerous occasions and other leaders in that area. A lot more to learn about electromagnetic pollution and a lot more to learn about nanotechnology. All of these things are, we're almost having experiments thrust upon the population with no scientific data. Or what sometimes there is scientific data and it doesn't look too good,
Mm-hmm.
You can see why we're having the problems we're having. So that's what, but muscle testing really is something that anybody can learn to do. You might have to have a partner to do it. I'm not saying you can always do it by yourself, but that can often tell you what is going on. And if you don't feel well, you can muscle test various things that, you know, and determine the cause of the problems. It could be mold exposure. It could be your diet. It could be chemical toxicity. It could be, you know, an intracellular infection. You know, there's a lot of those going around. And all of that, you can determine why you don't feel well.
We do have a lot of wisdom available to us if we just take advantage of it or do a timeout like we used to say as kids and, mm-hmm. and focus on what really matters to us. You know, that's for sure. And that was part of the passion of my book is just seeing so many people in the world that seem to be so emotionally drained and walking, one would call them the walking dead, and I'm just talking about energy, you know, rather mm-hmm. than thriving and vibrant. And, I mean, life is so fascinating, you know, and offers us so much mystery if we keep ourselves open to experience it and see it.
So a lot of your book talks about energy management. Can you share with the audience some of the things that you recommend in order to conserve energy, to manage energy, so that you do have that enthusiasm for life rather than going around, you know, exhausted and just dragging through life?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a whole area that I talk about as far as energy with the body, and certainly in the ways of a lot of practices, that's more your area of expertise. But when it comes to just day-to-day common sense for me, it's half my body weight, drinking good water. The other thing that I think is plaguing our society now is the immense profanity that people use just in everyday conversation. Many years ago, you know, if you heard somebody use a word of profanity once, it would be like, oh, well, that was interesting. And now you almost have to filter through, you know, the movies that you go mm-hmm. and see. For me, it's not a religious issue. It is an energy issue. And what I say is that would be applicable to muscle testing. You know, mm-hmm. go and use certain curse words and things like that and go, well, it's not that big of a deal, it's just a word. But then muscle test yourself and you will see that that's not really the case mm-hmm. at all. For me, energy is we get what we bring. So when I bring energy to the table of life, that's what I get back. Often people label things they do during the week of, you know, tending to the grandchild that just takes my energy versus a same situation, same scenario, someone down the street could say, oh, I love that. You know, it just mm-hmm. gives me that zest for life. More often, it's not what we're attending to. It's our judgment about what we're tending to. It's the energy behind the energy, if you will, to those events that are zapping us. So that's just the common sense piece of it, is that the dread often that we put behind just ordinary, simple events. The other element is that people today aren't exposed enough to just natural resources and being out in nature and being grounded to the earth and being mindful of nature and all the things that are around them that are so vibrant. And that's just crucial. Often people spend times in automobiles, vehicles of some kind, concrete floors, inside homes, inside office buildings, and they're not getting enough of that wonderful rejuvenation of just good old-timey outdoor time. It's considered silent meditation. It rejuvenates our being. It keeps us grounded and centered. I think that a lot of people believe that they have to make the energy, they have to generate the energy, and they have to create it. And energy comes from our creation resource. That would be my belief on that. We have to maintain it. We make good decisions as far as a good night's sleep, the nutrition, those levels of emotions we were talking about earlier. But when it comes to an energetic being, my day doesn't begin based upon what I have left from the rest of the week. And, mm-hmm. and people develop almost a mantra of they'll even start a week on Monday talking about how tired they're going to be on Friday.
Right.
And that putting that into that faith bucket of that's what's going to happen when energy is right now, infinity is right,
right.
now. And so it's learning how to create a whole different mindset to that. I recently said goodbye to one of my little Yorkies. I lost two of them. They were 14, and they were brothers. And one died very suddenly. And shortly after that, the little brother didn't, you know, want to be here. And they were like my kids. So I'm grieving. I'm tending to the remaining one. With the depth of my being, and I had many nights that we weren't talking sleep. And no, I wouldn't advise that to anybody. The point being, I wasn't driven or governed by that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's a new day. Here we go. I have a vibrancy in my body and my being. But a lot of people, they disassociate from where true energy comes from.
Yeah, I wrote a chapter in a book called Optimism. It was 42 different authors on optimism, and my chapter was on energy management, and it's a topic I've actually lived because I was, you know, a trauma surgeon, often staying up all night, running a practice, doing, you know, 16-hour surgeries, So energy management's a topic that I've studied most of my life and I'm very, very interested in. One thing I did not put in that chapter, but I think is important, is an observation I think William James made, and that's that if we do anything for more than 4 hours, we can become tired. And if you just do things for 4 hours, it's not always possible, obviously, but so I would try to make my day where I would get up and operate 4 hours, see clinic for 4 hours, do administrative work for 4 hours, and then go back out and do trauma surgery for 4 hours, and then try to sleep for 6 hours, you know. But it really is true that if you can just limit your activity for 4 hours and then switch, you have a lot more energy. It's just a very interesting observation.
That's a great practice. It makes perfect sense. I mean, just hearing you say that, it's like, yeah, that makes absolute sense. Absolute
yeah, the
sense.
Really bad shifts were the 12-hour ER shifts, you know, where you had to see patients for 12 hours. Because you're pretty tired at 8, okay, if you're doing the same thing. But by 12 hours, you're pretty exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, but you can keep going and going if you switch what you're doing.
Hmm.
So that's
absolutely.
One little energy management.
Absolutely.
Thing.
And for me, a great thing for me was to have a geographical relocation. The area that I lived in at that particular time had the belief about, you know, that you get old. And I thought, I need to seek, you know, other horizons. So I moved to Florida where people have a whole different kind of energy around longevity. And
right.
There's a big distinction when we talk about an energy field between getting old and aging.
Mm-hmm.
And aging seems to be where we are now as human beings, inevitable, where growing old is a whole different kind of mindset that mm-hmm. is within people or systems. Or believing that when you go to through tragedy, it will make you old, where for me, going through tragedy has the capacity to bring more out of me than what I started with. So it's again, it's a whole different practice that we don't change it necessarily overnight, but over time, we can see that that would be true. And we've seen many people prove it to us. For example, Betty White is a great model, continues to do new things. Goodness knows she's had immense loss in her life. She's gone through a lot of things, but yet she still shows up to the table. I love that, you know, when you see people. I often wonder, and you're probably more the person to ask than even thinking about my own thoughts, but why we went for the 4-minute mile. Why don't we go for doubling our life expectancy?
Well, I think that in the future, we're going to be able to live our true life expectancy, which is probably between 120 and 150.
Okay.
Right now, our planet is too polluted. It's too life is too complicated, I think, to live that long.
Mm-hmm.
I think a huge number of people are dying of cancer in their 80s, and that's probably cumulative carcinogens and a lot from parasites that, you know, don't get cleaned out, and electromagnetic radiation, geopathic stress. There's a number of causes of cancer. That's one of my favorite projects, is treating cancer, because I like to go for the cause of it and then treat the cause. And that's a lot more effective than just trying to kill the cancer, because I don't think that'll ever work.
Right.
But I think that with this new energy coming in the next few years, that's going to allow cleaning up of our institutions, which is important because, in my mind, we have to clean the planet up, clean the air up, clean the water up, clean the food supply up in order to reach that longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will be possible, but it's not possible in the world we live in now. But, of course, you know, you probably have the same belief system that I do. I believe we're eternal, so it doesn't really matter. You know, you drop your body in your 70s or 80s or 90s and then come back in. Does it really matter if you stay an extra 20 or 30 years, you know? It quality of life is what's important. When the quality of life goes out, then I just as soon drop the body and
right.
come back in again. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not real. If you're really eternal, it doesn't matter.
Well, it seems to me that most of us are, mostly you and I, are spending our time as life advocates, speaking on behalf of how to have a vibrant life.
Mm-hmm.
And what that can look like.
Yeah, it's important now because of the state of the planet, the food supply, you know, the dangers out there that people are not aware of, cell phone use and, you know, cordless phone use, that kind of thing. I just try to educate people, as you do. I think energy management is a wonderful, thing to study during life. And the thing that can drain us faster than anything are negative emotions. You know, negative emotions, you might be feeling wonderful and you have somebody or even some circumstance, it doesn't have to be another person, punch you in the gut energetically and you are drained of your energy. So a big part of energy management is controlling the degree that your energy can be lost through fear, through anger, through the negative emotions, jealousy, envy, any of the negative emotions. You know, just limiting that through, I guess, discipline and spiritual practices. So
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
And in scripture, where it says to him much is given, much is held accountable, to me, for me, that's what that means. That, you know, the more we put intention towards our vibration, our attitude, our thinking, our owning our feelings, and those kind of things, for us to lower our standards, you can feel your body immediately zap. You know, when you get into that small stuff again, it's like, whoa. You know, it becomes like immediate zapping. It's like, whew, what was I thinking?
And that becomes important, to be an observer of your energy level, to observe what takes it. I think until you become the observer, you're not going to learn how to manage your energy, because you won't know the triggers. And if you know, I mean, you're just being, you know, kind of thrown around by different emotions and what other people think and what other people say to you. And, you know, you have no actual ability to weather any storms, because you don't realize what all the variables are. And that's how meditation helps. I think meditation helps you be the observer of your energy and emotions.
I totally am with the heart archetype. Meditation, whether it's walking or stillness or quiet, It keeps us in a place of not being righteous and controlling and all the other factors of the way that we can use our energy in not the most constructive ways. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Temple, we're coming up at the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Absolutely. My website is templehayes.com. That's H-A-Y-E-S. And that tells about my weekly radio show, the cruises that I give as pilgrimages, and all the information is on there, including the new book. And again, it's just a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for doing what you're doing in the world.
Well, thanks, Temple. Appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Absolutely. Many blessings.
Thank you. We've been interviewing Temple Hayes, the author of When Did You Die? 8 Steps to Stop Dying Every Day and Start Waking Up. Next week, we're interviewing Miriam Knight, What Wags the World, Tales of Conscious Awakening. And then on the 24th, Joel Apana, The Book of Positive Light, Remembrance of the Heart. Then Cindy Bentley, Know Your Soul Path, on the 31st. We do not have Noetic Science in January, but we will resume it again in February. Noetic Science is the third Thursday of every month at 7:15 at the Dunwoody office here in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show.